Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, January 6th, 2016, during a live teleform conference call. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleform conference call. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased as we start the new year to begin with two return guests to Teleforum. We'll start with opening remarks from each of about 5 to 10 minutes, then some back and forth. And as always, time for your questions, so please do be thinking of those questions. We'll hear first from Andrew C. McCarthy. He's a senior fellow at National Review Institute, published widely. And he'll be followed by Professor David F. Forte. He's a professor of law at Cleveland State University and Cleveland Marshall College of Law. Let's get right to the program with that. Andy McCarthy, the floor is yours.
Thanks so much, Dean, and it's great to be here. Great to, in particular, to be with David and to start the new year off with a Federalist Society event. I'm sure it's going to be an eventful year, so hopefully we'll do the start of it some justice. I think what precipitated the conference that we're having today is the reaction to the recent terrorist attack in San Bernardino and the fact that the government yet again, in responding to it, initially refused to come to grips with the fact that it was, number one, Islamic terrorism, and number two, that there is a root in the of the terrorism in Islamic scripture. In that connection, I wrote a column about it that really repeated a theme that I've been trying to hit at for years, which is that the government in Washington and most of the governments in the West, and this is not specific to either party, it's been the practice in the United States of both parties, has essentially created an Islam of its very own. That is to say, an Islam that is the official United States government interpretation of Islam that bears little or no resemblance to Islam as it actually exists, particularly the mainstream Islam of the Middle East. And the way that this, I think the best illustration of this is a comment made by the former British Home Secretary, Jackie Smith, who is sounding very much like our government has sounded since I first got involved in counterterrorism in the mid-1990s, branded terrorism as anti-Islamic activity, which is to say that the savagery involved in terrorism is not merely unrelated to Islam, but becomes by dint of its being violence contrary to Islam. And this has to be so because our government, the British government, and other governments of the West hold that Islam is a religion of peace, and therefore that any savagery committed by Muslims is the fact that they're Muslims is mere happenstance. It doesn't have anything to do with Islamic doctrine. My argument in response has always been that this is absurd, and I say this stipulating for purposes of our discussion that there are various ways of interpreting Islam and that millions of Muslims manage to contextualize Islamic scripture's numerous commands to conduct holy war by reasoning that these divine injunctions applied only to their historical place and time and are no longer relevant. And that really takes into account only the Muslims who care to wrestle with that part of their doctrine. I think it's fair to say that there are also millions upon millions of Muslims who are indifferent to what the spiritual or the scriptural commands say. They go about their lives not remotely or any more remotely interested in terrorism and advancing any kind of a political agenda by terrorism than any other people in the United States or the West. But all that having been said, It's simply undeniable that there is a textual command to make war against non-Muslims that is a theme that runs throughout the Quran and the Sunnah, which is the another source of Islamic scripture, the lessons to be drawn from the words and deeds of the Prophet. And the fact is that there is a strong strain of interpretation of Islam that accepts this as a very active, live doctrine that commands Muslims to make war on non-Muslims in order to establish Sharia, which is Islam's societal framework and law. And I think it's a waste of our time in the United States to debate what has been debated for about 20 years, which is whether this is the true Islam or not, whether this is a faithful interpretation of Islam or not. Because, number one, as non-Muslims, that's not a matter of great importance to us. And number two, as Americans, we have to protect the national security of the United States, irrespective of how that debate within Islam comes out. And for our purposes, that is the purposes of protecting national security, it really doesn't make any difference whether the jihadists and those who think along their lines, who I call Islamic supremacists, these are Muslims who want to establish Sharia, whether they want to do it by violence or not. Their interpretation, what I should say is they believe in this literalist interpretation of Islamic scripture. And as long as they believe it, it really doesn't matter to us whether it's right or it's wrong. We have to protect the country regardless. And consequently, I've been trying to argue for many years that it's irresponsible of our government to pretend that this is not a legitimate interpretation of Islam, a mainstream interpretation of Islam, particularly in the parts of the world that are the greatest threat to the United States. It makes no sense to conduct a war without studying the enemy's threat doctrine. It makes it impossible for us to understand why they attack and when and where they are most likely to attack in the future. It would be absurd in any other context to think that we would be at war with an ideological enemy and not taking its ideology into account. And while I think it is admirable in the American tradition to give religious liberty a wide berth, I would point out that with respect to Sharia, what we're dealing with is only a very small percentage of what we're dealing with is actually made up of tenets that that are actually religious in the strict sense as we understand it in the West. There's no doubt that, you know, things like the oneness of Allah, the duty to pray five times a day, the belief that Muhammad is the final prophet, they all are religious tenets, and I don't think anybody is disputing that. But in large part, I would say 80 to 90% of what is covered by Sharia and Islamic doctrine is not religion as we see it in the West. And that's largely because Islam does not recognize, or at least the strain of Islam, does not recognize a distinction between the spiritual realm and political and civic life. So if we are going to say that the American tradition and constitutional requirement of religious liberty requires us to be blind to somebody's belief system, we are going to miss about 85 or 90% of an ideology that has absolutely nothing to do with religion and is in fact not only totalitarian in the sense that it wants to cover all aspects of life, but is antithetical to the United States system of law and our Constitution in basic ways. So I think it's long overdue for us to, in a realistic way, study the enemy's ideology and understand what motivates the people who we are fighting against. And I think it's perilously foolish for us to continue along the vein that says that Islam is completely unrelated to the threat that we're dealing with. Well, Dean, I'd leave it at that for the moment.
Okay. David Forte?
Thank you. Andy's done a great service to the public discourse about Islam, and his codification phrase, supremacist Islam, I think is catching on because it is so accurate. So the question is, where did it come from and what does it constitute? And then once we know the roots of this ideology and its current profile in the Middle East, what's the best way to defend against it and defeat it? First of all, Sharia, which is traditionally a collection of rubrics done in the 13th and 14th, 12th century and handed on since there, is not the whole of Islamic law. The vast majority of Islamic law as lived under by Muslims was ordinances by the empire. And the ordinances always took precedence if there was a conflict over any rubric that might be in the Sharia books. Secondly, the Sharia as a whole only has a very small portion of it, though it's a very bad portion of it, morally speaking, that's devoted to public law. The vast amount of the pages of a Sharia compilation is on dietary restrictions, on prayer, and then there's a middle area which is on civic relations, some of which, such as relations between husband and wife, can be a subject of public policy. But only a small part of it was what we would call public law dealing with war and relations with other religions. It is not coincidental that this public part was formed primarily in the 8th, 9th, and 10th centuries in a connection with the ambitions of an empire. So it has an imperial tone to it in its content, the public part of the Sharia to begin with. During the Ottoman Empire, which is the longest-running empire, the Sharia was often, or Islamism, what we would now call Islamism, was used as a motive and energy for an imperial ambition. It would give it a focus, but when the ideology got in the way, the Sultan simply ignored it. For example, the Sharia judges all through the Ottoman Empire capped interest at 10% and enforced it, even though the Sharia says it's illegal. Prostitutes typically in Constantinople were not stoned, but were regulated by the state. On the other hand, if the Sharia got in the way of the empire, the Sultan had no qualms of by ignoring it, as in his outrageous capture and forced Islamic conversion of male youths into his janissaries from Eastern Europe. Most of the records that we are now unearthing of the Sharia courts in the Ottoman Empire find that they were simply boards of inquiry and setting up a set of facts, and the resultant penalties or pains or resolutions were done solely by members of the bureaucracy and not by the Islamic jurists themselves or under the law of the Islamic jurists, who were fireable at will by the Sultan. Moreover, during the Ottoman Empire, there was a huge corpus of law that was known as fatwa law, which we know the term now, that was put out by the chief mufti, who was appointed by an advisor to the vizier and the Sultan. And these fatwas made dramatic changes in many parts to the Sharia law. though they were never incorporated into the old Sharia books. So when you get an atavistic group such as ISIS in the 20th century, such as the Salafist movement, and they go back to what they think are original scriptures or even to the what they think is the original Sharia, they hop-skip over the modifying elements that imperial politics did to the Sharia. And what you have now is a strain of Islam, but it is a radical strain of Islam. It is Islamic extremism, which I think is the right term. It's both Islamic and it's extreme in terms of Islam, that takes these versions and these texts and translates it into an imperial, theocratic, intolerant ideology that's opposed to the West and that winds up opposed to the majority of other Muslims' lives as well. The Salafist movement began in actually in the late 19th century, really got moving in the early 20th century with the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, when Islam went through a crisis of identity it hadn't had since the 800s. That is a full 1,000-year difference, and had a crisis of identity. And Islamic Muslim states, particularly in the Middle East, tried all kinds of experiments, Marxist, liberal, capitalist, nationalist. In the meantime, the Salafist movement began to grow, and it was given great intellectual credence by Sayyid Qutb, whose books, he was a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, have fueled its sort of intellectual cogency. How did it really get the edge that it had today? Well, there was this very weird constellation between its ideology and Saudi money. Up until 1973, the Saudis were regarded as a State Department person once told me when I was on lecture tour in the Middle East, as the religious yahoos of the Middle East. They were the strange outliers. Their Wahhabism was sort of a weird fundamentalism. Well, after the oil shocks in 73, the Saudis went on a spending proselytizing binge, and that's where they set up these madrasas all over the place, began financing schools that trained imams in their Wahhabism. And it's there, which of course has come back to bite them, but nonetheless, it's Saudi money, Saudi is our ally, and Salafist intellectualism, which is given the energy to this movement. So now that we do have a movement, and it's primarily, though not exclusively, it's spreading in the Middle East, and it has a good culture to develop in the Middle East because of a number of cultural elements of the Middle East. The lack of an assimilationist culture, whereas in Indonesia you have a Buddhist assimilationist culture that modifies Islam. A tradition of tribalism, where there's always us against them, and many other aspects that help it to thrive, including some major Western missteps in the area. The question is, how do you deal with it? As Andy points out, there's been a great deal of debate as to what you call it. Now, when President Obama and former Secretary of State Clinton said they don't want to call it Islamic, and they give two reasons. One is they don't want to validate ISIS, and two, they don't want to alienate other Muslims and saying, oh, you're as bad as ISIS. There is a cogency to that because words have important diplomatic effect, as Jean Kirkpatrick told us. Remember, Jean Kirkpatrick got the Zionism is racism resolution repealed because its words had very bad effect. When George Bush first used the term Islam as a peaceful religion, you have to understand in the context in which he used it. He used it in the very same speech, if I'm not mistaken, when he said, you're either with us or against us. And so by saying Islam is a peaceful religion, it has always been not a description, but a diplomatic tactic. It is to say, if you're with us, we presume that you are going to follow a peaceful path and whatever you call your religion. If you're against us, then you're against us. And it was that use of the term, not a descriptive one. Now it's become a kind of put blinders on subsequently. But I think we should not worry about the term too much. I think the term Islamic extremism is both accurate. It shows that it's Islamic and it shows that it's extreme and not as much of a mainstream element of Islam as Andy suggests. It is now in the Middle East. There are practically no good guys left in the Middle East, but it never was the kind of action. And I'll conclude by saying this, that even though Islamic supremacism is the ultimate ideological problem we're facing, the particular example of that we have in ISIS has been condemned, so far as I can see, by every Muslim leader around the country, around the world. It's been condemned by the largest Muslim organization in the world, the one in Indonesia, which was formed as a peaceful, 50 million people, formed as a peaceful organization to combat Wahhabism. And so you already have a line drawn between what ISIS is doing and what other Muslims claim is Islam. And I see no problem with exploiting in a propagandic and diplomatic way that line in order to isolate and defeat this terrible enemy. And then the next one, which is Iran, which is just similar but better organized. And I'll stop at that point.
Very good. Thank you both. I want to give Andy McCarthy a chance to respond, but before and as I do that, let's open the floor to questions so people can begin queuing up. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, and I hope you do, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got nearly 40 minutes left for Q&A. Andy McCarthy, what about, if you could respond and then maybe address one of the points that Professor David Forte made, what about the idea of not alienating the vast majority of peaceful Muslims, those who feel that their religion is being co-opted?
Well, Dean, first of all, I agree with almost everything David said, and I particularly appreciate his kind words. In response to your question, just by way of background, I ought to point out that the first Muslims that I got to meet when I got involved in counterterrorism back in 1993 were not jihadists. They were actually pro-American, pro-Western Muslims who were helping us infiltrate the blind sheikh's cell that actually carried out the World Trade Center bombing in 1993 and attempted a simultaneous set of bombings against New York City landmarks later that year that we were able to thwart precisely because we had a pro-Western Muslim informant who infiltrated the cell and enabled us to stop them in the midst of that plot. So I'm sensitive, and I've always been sensitive to the need not to unduly alienate people who I think we should regard as our allies. And consequently, the reason I have thought that Sharia is a good dividing line for us to follow, much more so than terrorism, is that with respect to Sharia, if you find Muslims who don't want Sharia to become the law of the land, who don't want the Constitution supplanted with Sharia, and who are in the West precisely because they want to live in this kind of a society, those are our allies, and we want to keep them as our allies. And I have a pretty constant running argument with a lot of people on my side of the debate who want to take the position that Islam is the problem. And I do believe that Islam is a problem that we have to work around, but I also think it's foolish to suggest that a religion is simply what the doctrine says, because as David pointed out, there are a variety of sources of Sharia law. Part of it, of course, is the Quran, and part of it is the Sunnah, but also a large part of it is how those doctrinal requirements have been interpreted over time by the authoritative people within Islam. And consequently, culture has throughout history had an enormous impact on how Islam is practiced. And I'm frankly more interested in how it's practiced than in what the doctrine says. I know what the doctrine says. I think we should all know what the doctrine says. But clearly a religion is about more than simply what the doctrine says. And the allies that we have in the Muslim community are very valuable to us if we're to protect the country. I think that we should do what we can in terms of the intra-faith struggle among Muslims to try to empower pro-Western Muslims actually isolate, and I think marginalize to the extent we can, characters like the Muslim Brotherhood, whose ideology is what all that Saudi money that David talked about has really fueled throughout the West. I think our policy has been all wrong to the extent that we took an idea, namely outreach to the Muslim community, which was in its place a good idea, especially after 9/11, when we were at such an intelligence deficit. It was important to try to reach out to friends in the Muslim community, both for intelligence purposes and all other national security purposes. But we ended up reaching out, to my mind, mostly to all the wrong Muslims, to organizations that were connected to the Muslim Brotherhood and who did not have America's best interests at heart. So I think we should recognize the division between pro-Western Muslims and Islamic supremacists. I think Sharia is the good dividing line to make that assessment, and we should be trying to marginalize the people who are on the wrong side of that line. So to that extent, I think we have to protect the United States no matter what. And while it's important to the extent we can to avoid giving gratuitous offense to people, at the same time, Muslims of goodwill, and particularly pro-Western Muslims, understand that we can't safeguard the country and have any hope of defeating the enemy without grappling with their ideology, which, for better or worse, is drawn from a literal interpretation of Islamic scripture. So I do think that we want to be careful how we go about this. I agree that words are important, but I also think that they're not as important as what is necessary to do to protect the country. And Muslims of goodwill will understand that. Muslims who say they are offended by that, I think we ought to tell them, sorry, we're offending you, but we have to do what we have to do to protect the country.
Once again, if you have a question, we don't have any questions pending at this point, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let me make our regular commercial announcement about upcoming Teleforum conference calls while we're waiting to see if anyone else rings in. Tomorrow at 1 p.m., we'll have a preview of a very important Supreme Court case, the Friedrichs case. It's a chance for the Supreme Court to overrule the Abood case. That's tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Then on Friday at 2 p.m., we'll be talking about class action litigation, and in particular, a case in which Ted Frank, a return guest to Teleforum, is an objector or an intervener, where the attorney's fees, the amount of the attorney's fees, far outstripped by a factor of, I think, 15, the award to the entire class of plaintiffs. So that's Friday at 2 p.m. Today, of course, we're talking to Professor David Forte and Andy McCarthy, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone if you'd like to ask a question. Let me see if I can ask David Forte. David, was there much that you've heard from Andy McCarthy? Andy, you mentioned that you agree with almost everything David Forte said, but I want to try and tease out the differences where you guys might differ on these issues. So let me ask a question that way to David, Professor Forte.
I might have to disappoint you. I'm going to say something Andy has said before, but which dovetails with my point that words have meaning, and it's this, and then I'll make a concluding point about it, which may differ a bit from Andy. As much as I see and approve in context of Obama's and Clinton's attempt not to paint this ideology as mainstream Islam, I understand that as a diplomatic movement. As Andy's pointed out, their other policies have perversely done exactly the opposite. When all your policies regarding violence that these extremist Muslims are attributed to nasty words or nasty films that the United States has uttered or that Westerners have uttered or that cartoons have drawn, you in fact validate the exact extremism you claim is not part of Islam. And you validate it as part of Islam. It is the most perverse attitude, and I think it goes to the old-fashioned current liberal idea that offensiveness is the benchmark of whether something is valid or invalid. But that does get me to it may be a methodological difference between my perspective, which is kind of mushy academic, and Andy's. Andy's has been one of the best lawyers and prosecutors in this country for decades. And when I read Andy's, every one of Andy's articles, it is a brief. There's a right answer. There's an argument he wants to win. But a lot of the diplomacy is by increments, and words are in diplomacy. You don't necessarily want to win. You want to better your position relative to somebody else, and that takes a more nuanced form of argument, the kind of argument that I'm a little bit more sensitive to, and that's why I don't jump off the handle when people say Islam is a religion of peace, unless they're trying to describe the essence of it, and then. If they're a Sufi and they say Islam is a religion of peace, I'll listen to them. But I think it's a diplomatic tactic. But it has to be done within the context of a vigorous diplomacy that's isolating your enemy at all levels and not validating what he does with the right hand when you've just tried to invalidate it with the left hand.
All right, we do have a couple questions now. So let's turn to our first question, not only of the call, but of the year.
Hi, my name is Bill James, and my background, I'm a West Point grad, and relative to legal platforms and legal approaches, if the federal government declared the causes which impel in the war on terror, in other words, actually declared war so that we have a definition of the objective, then wouldn't this stuff be more clear? In other words, isn't it our lack of self-discipline to define an objective a significant part of the problem of why we can't define our relationships relative to culture versus religion?
Well, who wants to take a shot at that?
I'll start at that. I'll make two points. First, the mechanism of using the phrase declare war as opposed to stating your objective, the mechanism of using declare war is not the mechanism to use. We've only had 5 declared wars in our history. We've had plenty of objectives that we've accomplished militarily and a number that we haven't accomplished militarily. The declare war gets us into a whole messy issue between congressional and presidential power that we don't want to open that can of worms. We just need a congruence of that. Of views as to what the objective is. Now, President Obama has finally stated the objective is to degrade and defeat ISIS. He hasn't expanded the objective to say that a supremacist ideology of any form needs to be contained and contended with, which I think is what Andy is attempting to, and I think rightly. So he has defined the objective in terms of the worst, most violent, and most human rights violation enemy that we have. His execution leaves a lot to be desired, but he has. And he said it at another point, too. Again, I think, I feel embarrassed to say so many nice things about him. He said that the conflict in the Middle East has to be managed. In a deeper sense, that's right, because what you have in the Middle East is not only an ideological struggle within Islam, an ideological struggle between various elements of Islam and the West, but you have four atavistic empires seeking to reestablish themselves. You go to a map and you look at the Ottoman Empire and you see what Erdogan wants. You go to a map and you look at the Russian Empire, at least as Catherine the Great envisaged it, and you see what Putin wants. And you go to a map and you see what the Safavid Empire in Persia had, and that's what the Iranians want. And then you go to a map and look at the Umayyad Empire, which is what ISIS wants. They're all in the same territory. That kind of conflict cannot be won in a deeper sense. It can only be managed. It has to be managed well.
Wouldn't it be then, under the idea of managing, wouldn't it be useful then to look at letters of marque and other ways of not directly engaging U.S. forces, but creating a constitutional basis for long-term management? Because the military is a very finite and clumsy thing. It's very powerful, but clumsy, in that once you commit it, you're stuck.
Well, let me say a couple of things in response. What I've been afraid about as far as declaring war is concerned, or even revising the existing authorization for the use of military force, is that rather than targeting the threat, we'll get a unfortunately politicized document. I mean, when Obama talks about revising the authorization for use of military force, he's talking about putting, you know, temporal and geographical limitations on it that are unrealistic and unrelated to facts on the ground. And for that reason, I reluctantly think that at least as long as he is in office, we're better off with what we have, which is not by any means perfect, but at least gives us what we need in the way of legal authority to attack the jihadist enemies that we're the non-state jihadist actors that we're currently facing. I think much more important than the form of declaring war or authorizing combat operations is our understanding of what the mission is, and I think that's what you're getting at, Bill. And I continue to think that the test that President Bush articulated about 7 days after the 9/11 attacks is the best route to prosecuting this war. Now, there's a lot about that I don't like. I think that, you know, for example, calling the war on terror invites exactly the you know, the kind of confusion and lack of aim and strategy that you refer to in your first question, because terrorism is obviously it's a method, it's not an enemy. But what Bush said a week after the attacks is that we have to attack the jihadists, meaning at the time al-Qaeda and its affiliates, without geographical limitation wherever they operate. And we have to treat nations that aid and abet the terrorists as hostiles. And I did not take that ever to mean that meant we had to invade every country that was helping the terrorists, but it did mean that we should turn the levers of government power against them in a way that treated them as hostile. And that while you don't take military force off the table, there are a lot of other pretty potent levers of power that we have to try to squeeze regimes like the Iranians. And to me, the Iranians, even back then, and I should point out that by 9/11, they had already had a decade's worth of an operational relationship with Al-Qaeda. And the 9/11 Commission even points out some pretty intriguing details about potential Iranian involvement in the 9/11 attacks. We know that they harbored Al-Qaeda after the 9/11 attacks. We know that they continued to support Sunni terrorism against the United States in Iraq and Afghanistan afterwards. That's a long-winded way of saying I don't think you can do what needs to be done to protect the United States if you have a strategy that's just related to ISIS or just related to non-state jihadists and doesn't take into account the state actors that that aid and abet them. So I know that the test that Bush laid out is not an easy one to follow because we have a lot of very difficult people that we have to work with in the world, like the Saudis and the Pakistanis and so on. But I do think you have to have a strategy, whatever you call it, whether it's a declaration of war or a declaration of strategy, that takes into account not just the jihadists, but the state actors as well.
But you could do, let's take ISIS as an example. You could do a 2 or 3 division raid for 3 months where you sit here and say, you've declared war on us. We are going to act against that. But then it's a short term and you pull the military back out. You're not there for nation building. You're or against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda into Afghanistan, a 3 to 6 month raid where you're dealing with the military threat, but you're not nation building and you're not trying to occupy things without a declaration of war. Without a declaration of war, all right, so von Clausewitz defines power as the will and ability to win applied to achieving an objective. If you have no objective defined by the political authorities, soldiers aren't going to find it on a battlefield.
Well, but they're not going to be sent into a battlefield without a mission. Well, I guess I shouldn't say that, right?
Well, I disagree with that.
But I, you know, look, I've been an opponent of the Democracy Project going back to the Bush years, it goes a long way toward the argument that we've been trying to make that you need to understand the enemy's ideology. I mean, I think that there are people in Washington to this day who don't understand how Sharia is understood in that region and don't grasp that. As Sheikh Karadawi of Muslim Brotherhood would say, if you have a foreign Western force who invades a Muslim territory, they're regarded as the enemy, and they have to be fought even by terrorism until they're driven out. And the fact that they may subjectively think that they're there to make life better for Muslims doesn't prevent it from being a provocative act. The way that they understand their doctrine. I think that if we understood that was where they were coming from, we probably, have had a different strategy during those years. But to the extent that, David points out that you can't defeat everything. You have to manage problems like that region. And there are intractable problems in that region that have to be managed for sure. But I also think that national security threats occur within the ambit of things that you have to manage. And if they're real national security threats, they can't be managed. They have to be defeated. So I've been against, for example, us jumping into the conflict in Syria, just as I was against us jumping into the conflict in Libya. I don't see the point in taking sides between one set of anti-American jihadists and another set of anti-American jihadists. That said, if we know that once a terrorist organization has safe space, it's going to use that space as a launch pad for attacks against the United States and American interests, then we can't tolerate that situation. So that has to be defeated. And I would go in and defeat it. And I would also say, for all the people who say, let's train the Kurds to do it, or let's get the moderate
the moderate Syrian rebels, if you can get both of them together, and have them do it. If you have an American national security problem, that's an American problem that we have to take care of. It doesn't mean that we need to, as the price of you know, quote unquote, liberating your basket case country, that we're now obliged to stay there for a decade or two and spend a couple of trillion dollars to try to turn Kandahar into Kansas. I don't think, you know, been there, done that. We should stop thinking that way. We shouldn't have thought that way in the first place. But we should absolutely go in and deny them safe space. And I think that's something that has to be done with American troops if we don't have sufficient allies on the ground, which we clearly don't.
I completely agree with you on that. The only thing that I think would disagree with you on both point, on this point is that should all still be subject to the rule of law under the Constitution, where the president has authority to do raids and short-term things without it being declared a war. But if you're going to declare war, you ought to declare the causes which impel. And then I'll let you go.
We've got a couple other questions pending. Andy or David, do you want to respond to that final point, or should we move on?
I'd like to move on right now.
Okay. Let's take another question from the audience.
This is David Applegate in Chicago. I'd like to thank both the speakers for a wonderful amount of information on the religious, political, military, and diplomatic aspects of what's going on. My question is this: surely the President of the United States has access to this level and quality of information as well, yet does not seem to have had a good job, to have done a good job in explaining the situation to the American people in a way that makes them feel safe. What advice would either of the speakers give to the next president of the United States, hypothetically speaking, of course, as a way to explain exactly what crisis the country is facing and how to deal with it in a way that would perhaps do a better job of making the average American voter and citizen feel safe?
Well, I guess I would just quickly say that we're not safe. And I think it's a part of what I've thought is a big problem for the last 20 years is that we, as a government, tell the public a lot of things that aren't true. I think we do better to try to get closer to what the truth is, which is it's not a situation in which we ought to panic. We are facing an enemy that if we got our strategy right, we got our ducks in a row, we could defeat what had to be defeated and manage what had to be managed. But we shouldn't be under any illusions that we're invulnerable to attack, because it simply isn't true.
No, I have nothing to add. I think that says it correctly.
Okay. We've got one question pending. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call.
Hi, it seems to me that we're actively supporting our enemies. Maybe it's to make boogeymen to frighten the populace with, but why was Gaddafi overthrown when he was engaged in an effort against these radical terrorists? We went to a great deal to overthrow him. Chris Stevens made the country safe for Islamic radical terrorists, and then Hillary had him made sure that he was not rescued when a raid was run against him and the people who surrounded him. Why are we supporting our enemies like this? And why are we destroying countries for the purpose of I don't know what?
I've long thought that we don't have any grown-ups in the White House for a long time, and I don't mean that certainly not in a racial way, but if you look at not that the grown-ups, as with George W. Bush, always gave him the right advice, but people who have a larger perspective and deeper experience of what the movements of world forces are. My understanding is that Obama went into Libya because he was frightened by, was it Susan Rice, on a massacre of civilians. But once he went in, he upset the whole balance of the situation and then had no idea of what was going to come afterwards. I also think he has a naive view that America somehow has been a colonialist regime. I think Chris D'Souza was absolutely right on this. D'Souza. And that he wants to ally with the anti-colonial peoples who happen to be the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and others. So it's just, I think, a particularly wrong perspective on what the position of the United States is and what our interests are in the sweep of world history that's been gripping this White House. And I think you just need people who have a larger sense, a larger instinct of what that is. Even Bill Clinton sort of had that larger. He came with some, and he had some good advisors. But if you look at H.W. Bush, you look at Reagan, they had this long-term, deep perspective of what this country was about and what it needed to be safe and what prudential foreign policy entailed. That's what we don't have now. We don't have prudential foreign policy. The practice of prudence to get what you can and then accept what you can to move on from there.
We do have a final question, so let's move to our final caller.
Hi, this is Lou Ebley. I'm calling from Detroit, and this is a question for either one of you. After 9/11, you may recall that there was some real concern that at some point in the future, and back then, I think they were talking 10 years, there was a concern that there could be a nuclear weapon detonated in the United States. You don't really hear too much about that anymore. And do you think that is a threat that we are facing, or do you think that was an overblown concern that could happen sometime in a major city in the United States?
I don't think it's an overblown concern. I think that it's a tribute to particularly the agents that we have working on the front lines who often have to do their jobs despite political wrangling and considerations that go on in their headquarters. They work much more effectively together, the intelligence and the law enforcement people, than they did when I got involved in this in 1993. I think one thing that has been inculcated in law enforcement and intelligence culture is the importance of sharing information and trying to get information into the right hands. And I don't think we should make the mistake of thinking that the safety that we've had, relative safety that we've had in this country in the years since 9/11, is a product of, or is a fact, is an outflow of having overestimated the threat. I think it's much more along the lines of that we took sensible precautions. Some of it is over the top. I mean, some of the stuff that Homeland Security does is over the top and ridiculous and constitutionally dubious. But I think where the rubber meets the road in terms of intelligence sharing and doing surveillance and getting out there and talking to the people who need to be talked to gather intelligence, the people we have on the front lines have done a really good job. And that's why I get concerned about things like Obama's countering violent extremism strategy, the design of which is to have the police and the intelligence people kind of pull back from the active gathering of intelligence and let, as he puts it, as the president puts it, our partners in the Islamic community be our eyes and ears to let us know if there's a problem that needs to be focused on, because I think a lot of the people the president has identified as partners do not necessarily have the best interest of the United States at heart, and even if they did, they would not be as good as the police and our other law enforcement at gathering the kind of relevant information that you need to stop terrorist attacks.
Right. Well, thank you. I mean, it does seem like a legitimate concern. I attended a seminar at Harvard Law School shortly after that, and they said the different type of terrorism that post 9/11 represented was, you know, back decades ago when you used to talk about the IRA or some other terrorist group, that yes, they wanted to impose damage, but they never wanted to do it on a horrific level because they wanted change. They didn't want destruction. And that now you had people that actually, you know, obviously 9/11, they would have loved to have killed 50,000 people.
Yeah,
and
well,
that it's at a whole new level, you know. And it is. It seemed to me it is a legitimate concern then and is now. That's why I wanted your opinion on that. Well, thank you.
Thank you, caller. Gentlemen, we have a minute or two for a final thought from each of you. Professor Forday, do you have a final thought?
My final thought is that, to repeat what I said earlier, maybe Andy can investigate this and correct me if I'm wrong, but the line we've gotten from even bad guys among Islamic supremacists in condemning as anti-Sharia, the acts of ISIS, I think, should be exploited. I think we should make that line deeper and redder, and point that out and begin to co-opt these other nations into and these other movements into assisting the battle against Islamic extremism.
Andy McCarthy, a final thought.
Yeah, I think that it would be valuable to tease that out. When I said earlier that I had I mostly agreed with David, the slight disagreement I had is with the suggestion of almost universal condemnation of ISIS among these various Islamic factions. I think it's true that ISIS has been widely condemned in the Islamic, in the Ummah at large. But I think the bases for the condemnation are different from group to group. And it just like it's important to divine which Muslims are pro-Sharia in the sense of wanting to impose it and which are not, I think it's also important to see why these different Islamic groups condemn ISIS. For example, if it's Al-Qaeda that's condemning ISIS, that's generally because they have a power struggle that's political in nature more than doctrinal. On the other hand, there are a lot of authentically moderate Muslims who condemn ISIS on a theological basis. And if that's a compelling basis, that is something that ought to be exploited, and we ought to be pressuring more Muslims to stand up and back that kind of an interpretation of Islam. But I just think we need to be better at picking out who our potential friends are and who our enemies are.
Well, we will leave it right there, gentlemen. I want to thank both Professor David Forte and Andrew McCarthy. Certainly appreciate your time today and your thoughts. I want to thank the audience as well for dialing in and for your questions. A reminder to our audience about our next scheduled telephone conference call tomorrow at 1 p.m. when we'll be looking at maybe one of the sleeper cases of the term, the Friedrichs case. That's tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. But until the next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.